for sellers, the storytelling element is so important. Understanding your story, how you fit in with the buyer, why the buyer is excited about your company, and who's telling the story. Do you have a CFO who can play that role? Is that the role your banker is going to play? Being open with information and understanding that you're in an interview process the entire time.
Welcome to the X Factor, where we visit with proven private equity-backed leaders to unpack a compelling area of value creation to help our listeners gain an edge. X Factor is presented by Private Equity CXO, the world's largest digital community of PE-backed executives. You can find a link to PECXO in the description to start your free membership and unlock exclusive content. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, partner at Falcon, a retained executive search firm exclusively recruiting C-level leaders for private equity-owned portfolio companies.
We have another unique episode for you today. My name is Lindsay Kozowski, partner at Falcon and CEO of The Crucible, and I am guest hosting X Factor this week. Today, I am joined by a robust panel of seasoned M&A experts, Meredith Bouchat, partner at Lowenstein Sandler, Eric Crabb, CEO at Valcourt Group, and Adam Oakley, Managing Director at Mesirow Investment Banking. We will discuss how PE-backed CXOs can thrive amid the current deal-making environment to maximize their M&A efforts. Welcome, panelists. Thank you to X Factor for having us on today's show, and let's get into it.
Thanks for having us, Lindsay.
Thank you.
So to get this started, I was hoping that each of you could give an overview of your impressions of the current deal-making environment. So would love to start with what we're seeing from the world of investment banking and just understand high-level trends and not just what you've been seeing over the last 6 months, but where you think it's headed in the near future. Adam?
Sure, I can start. It's been an interesting time, honestly, over the last 12 months or so have been, you know, somewhat stagnant coming off a very active period kind of through 2021 in the first half of 2022. And then, you know, really the second half of 22 and 23 so far have been a little bit slower from our perspective, from a deal-making standpoint. Obviously, some challenges with respect to the banking environment, the financing environment, and just general, I'll say, uncertainty from a macroeconomic standpoint. And so, you know, that's led to, I think, a little bit of a pause from an M&A standpoint. And, you know, while we're seeing deals get done, they're certainly taking a bit longer. And we're seeing some, you know, private equity owners, certainly, as well as founders and families, take a pause and look at timing and say, is now the right time, or is it going to be more advantageous 6 or 12 months from now to test the market? And so we've seen that slowdown. I think prospectively, our viewpoint, I can say this just based on pitch activity and general sentiment, I think our view is that over the next 6 or 12 months, there's going to be an increase in deal activity. Just as people settle in, there's a little bit more certainty from a macroeconomic standpoint. There's a little bit more clarity from an interest rate standpoint and where that's going to shake out in terms of potentially one more hike yet this year and then more of a steady state. So I think we're optimistic that 2024 are going to be more active more broadly from an M&A standpoint and particularly within the middle market. So that's kind of high level what we're seeing. I think within certain industry sectors, we've seen more pockets of activity in food and healthcare and some of the less sensitive, let's say, sectors as compared to others like A&D, where it's been a little bit more dodgy, let's say.
Gotcha. So Meredith, are you seeing similar trends coming from your side of the fence and the industries that you deal more with in the technology spaces? And also, what's the sentiment you're getting from some of the business owners that you're working with in trying to sell their companies?
Sure. So dodgy is a really good word for the current market, Adam. I'm seeing very similar trends. Buyers don't want to overpay, so they're taking their time testing the market. Sellers don't want to sell at the wrong price either. And diligence is a big theme. You know, you see the JP Morgan Frank deal, and everybody wakes up and says, oh, we do have to go slower. We have to do our homework. And by the way, we have the time, because it's not such a hot market that buyers are pushing each other out of the way to get a deal done. And so deals are taking longer to get done. Prices are being cut midway through diligence processes, and sellers are saying, if we have a choice, we're not going to sell right now. What ends up happening, though, is you have some companies that just don't play their cards right, where they're taking too long, waiting too long, and then they don't have a choice. And then you see fire sale situations, and those are really great for buyers who have an opportunity to pick up assets they wouldn't have otherwise been able to pick up, either on the cheap or through a bankruptcy process. Even we're starting to see more use of 363 sales with companies that just reach the end of their cash runway and their sponsors say, we're done. And that's a lot. That, you know, there are outlier deals. There are really good deals happening, but not a ton of them. But we're seeing companies start to shop the market because it is taking longer to get deals done.
Meredith, for those who don't know, can you just quickly define a 363 sale?
It's when a company goes into bankruptcy and sells its assets out of a bankruptcy process. So it takes a little more process, but it's a way to get buyers comfortable that they're not inheriting liabilities they don't want to inherit. Creditors get not full payback. Sorry for a shorthand.
No, not a problem. So in any case, Eric, how is the current market impacting strategic decision-making from the C-suite? And what does that mean for you as you're watching this market unfold where things are, to use the word of the day, a bit dodgier?
Sure. I think specifically as Adam and Meredith spoke to, I mean, things are certainly slowing down. I mean, we've been kind of in a roller coaster ride since COVID started in terms of the marketplace and, you know, the seller sentiment and buyer sentiment. Certainly, we kind of leaned into COVID, so to speak, in terms of finding the right opportunities in the right marketplaces, and we're transacting. But those opportunities required a lot more structure to get the deal done, given, you know, kind of historical financials. And then how does that look on a TTM basis versus, you know, what is the future going to look like? And then we saw a quick ramp in many of the businesses that we were looking at through 21 and 22. And I think they're still strong businesses today. There's just a little bit more cautionary approach to that. There's more, I think Meredith spoke to, more diligence being done in terms of really uncovering every rock. And there's not a speed component that needs to take place, where everyone was moving very quickly in 21, a little bit in 22. And I think 23 has been a little bit more of a cautious year. But I think it also depends on the businesses that you're looking at and the markets that you're looking at. Is it a process deal? Is it owner direct? How does that impact the timing? How does that impact the expectations? That pendulum takes a while to swing in terms of seller expectations. And a lot of early 23, the expectations were still, you know, late 21 expectations. And so we're seeing those come back kind of into the middle. And from our perspective, there's still a lot of great opportunities that are in the market today. And, you know, we'll see how that plays out over the next 6 to 12 months.
Eric, I think you hit the nail on the head with structure. We're seeing creative structure, lots of structure to get deals done. And what that means to me is it's not just cash at closing and you walk away. There might be an earnout component, so a lower purchase price up front. And then based on performance, the cap table gets paid more after the deal, more and more rollover. It used to be that private equity sponsors just had management roll a portion of their proceeds. We're seeing the whole cap table, the last private equity sponsor or the venture investors. We're seeing exited employees roll just so that less cash can be put up at closing, less use of the credit markets, and effectively using seller financing in that way, and lots of creative solutions everywhere in between.
And are you seeing that across the spectrum of size? Whether this is true in the lower middle market, true middle market, whether larger companies are struggling with the same things. I know we've seen that the credit markets across the board are creating some tightness and valuations are a concern for everyone. But are there specific pockets that are more constrained than others, or areas that are operating semi-normally?
I'm seeing it everywhere from $10 million deals to $2 billion deals. I was focusing more on exits to private equity, but when you're exiting to strategic buyers, I'm seeing use of a mix of cash and stock at exit. I'm seeing it across the board.
Yeah, I think same from my point of view. Certainly within the middle market, the smaller you go, the more likely I think you'll have burnout and that type of contingent consideration or seller financing. But certainly, you know, regular way middle market transactions in the say 50 to 250 range, we're definitely seeing an uptick in that presence of an earnout, which is something as a primarily sell side investment banker I try to steer my clients away from, but it just is simply not necessarily possible in situations today. So, you know, I think the biggest thing in spending a lot of time in aerospace and defense that we've seen is if you look back 2 years ago, there were situations where buyers would look at a particular business and say, okay, they've got activity on certain programs and we can project those out and have a pretty good feel for what the volumes are going to look like a couple of years in advance. And we can pay off of that. I think as we're in the market today, there's less willingness or ability to kind of look forward and give credit for particular programs or backlog. It's more of a, we'll pay you for the current business and we can structure around future growth or rebound on platforms and pay you that way. So it's, you know, a little bit more risk off from the buyer perspective and putting it on the seller at this time.
Eric, when you think about some of the transactions you're doing or looking at, is there a desire to engage these structures or to try to risk reduce more so than you have been seeing? Or is it trying to utilize more of, you know, available private equity monies? How is that changing your approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we approach any opportunity, it's kind of identifying that risk early and then either validating that risk or unvalidating that risk in terms of how we think about it from the outside once we get more involved in the business and really kind of peel back the covers there and make sure that we understand everything that's going on in that business. And I think through that, it helps determine what our structure looks like and how we think about, you know, utilizing that structure, whether it is an earnout, whether it's a holdback, whether it's a roll, what is the go forward for the owners? I mean, every deal has complexity to it, depending upon the owner's interpretations of what they want to do, the business, where it's going, where it's headed, the backlog of that business, the contracts of that business. So that's probably the main thing that we focus on as we're, you know, doing kind of the initial valuation and then also diligence is how do we think about the business and where does it lie? And how do we get comfortable with the risk in partnership with the partner, right? We're really looking to, you know, transact with a business that wants to be a partner with us and we want to be a partner with them. So, you know, from a kind of a strategic standpoint, we're looking at those deals as long-term partnerships with the seller in terms of, you know, what's best for them, what's best for their team, what's best for their business, what's best for their brand. That coupled with the risk is really where we're spending the most of the time is how do we, you know, feed those, you know, those components into our evaluation and then come up with the right structure that meets their expectations and certainly meets our expectations as well.
And in terms of expectations, and this is a broad question for the panel, there was increasing valuations and multiples for some period of time, which seemed to have flattened, or at least the desire to pay increasing multiples has disappeared. How is that impacting seller expectations? Has that changed?
Yeah, I can start on that. It takes much longer for seller expectations to move into line with the market than for buyers to kind of recalibrate based on the environment. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the impediments, right, coming off of all of the activity in 21 and first half of 22. There was a set level of expectations for sellers during that period of time. And, you know, despite the fact that the macro environment has changed, the lending environment has changed, it just simply takes a bit of time for seller expectations to get in line with the marketplace. And so I think that's the disconnect that ultimately forces either businesses to delay from going down the path of a process or for those that do launch a process to end up having a disconnect that, you know, you're a turn or two off in terms of where the buyer universe is at and where the seller expectations are. So That's a difficult thing in this type of dynamic environment to have seller expectations come back into line with the realities of the marketplace.
And when you have a seller that's backed by a financial sponsor, be it venture funds or private equity funds, you know, my sense is that those funds see the realities of the market faster than the management team does sometimes. And it's problematic for management teams because they're compensated in equity, which is now not worth what it was meant to be worth when they signed on for that job. And that's a challenge, right? They're not inclined to do a deal at a lower price point. So we're seeing a lot of conversations with management, repricing of equity, management carve-outs in M&A scenarios to make sure that the folks running the business are incentivized to do the deal. And that's what buyers want a lot of the time, right? The main asset will be the talent, and M&A will be successful or not based on how well they can integrate talent. We're seeing a lot of creativity around those structures and a lot of carrots and sticks for management coming from buyers. Eric, you talked about holdbacks. And we're seeing that in almost every deal now, whether the buyer's financial or strategic. Management is asked to wait for a portion of their deal proceeds based on staying with the company. Leads to a lot of negotiations around what happens if they're pushed out, what happens if they choose to leave, but lots of assurances being put in place that management will stay and be supportive of the deal. And yeah, I think it's important for those in the C-suite to know you should get your own counsel in connection with M&A and not just use company counsel. You can ask the company to pay for it. That's pretty normal. But that's an expectation you should have, is that you won't get everything right up front. If your equity is underwater, you should be getting something in connection with a deal, but it won't all be at the time of closing.
Yeah, I think from a seller position in the marketplace, to Adam's point, those expectations are slow to move. They're quick to move up, they're slow to move down. You know, we deal with a lot of owner-based businesses, founder-led. I've yet to meet a founder or an entrepreneur that doesn't expect next year to be the best year ever. Valuing that is hard sometimes. You know, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into what they do. And so figuring out, and not to take it back again to the kind of the structure component to that, but being able to bridge that gap for them is very important, to give them that opportunity to continue to see the growth in the business if it's coming, and to not penalize them from selling in a, you know, in a trough, so to speak, if the market turns in a way. But it's certainly something that, you know, the expectations are slower to come back than they were to go up.
So let's talk just a bit about valuation and how that's changing. We went through an abnormal time where sometimes the normalized EBITDA, it was not what it traditionally had been. And now we're at a place where multiples and credit markets seem less certain than they had been previously. How is that changing the valuation models? And where are the opportunities, both on the buyer and seller side, with regard to that differentiated value world of valuation these days? Adam?
One of the most difficult elements that we've seen is, what is that normalized level of EBITDA? There's so much noise in the numbers when you look back over the course of the last 3 years. I think there's a lot more discussion that needs to go into kind of aligning on that normalized level in order to start the process of identifying the valuation or the construct for evaluation. We try to do a lot of work up front, whether that's upfront quality of earnings to understand the historical levels, as well as spending a lot of time with the management teams to understand what's going on today, what are the next 6 or 12 months look like, to try to put some meat on the bones from a forecast standpoint so that we can put our best foot forward with buyers in those discussions to get as much credit going forward for the business continuing to perform and rebound. So that to me is the biggest thing as it relates to private equity deals in the financing markets, given what we're seeing in terms of higher interest rates, obviously, which take more cash to service, and then general pullback, I'll say, in the overall leverage levels that lenders are willing to put forth. You know, there is a structural impact there that is probably a 1 to 2 turns in what we've seen from an enterprise value to EBITDA multiple standpoint. you know, just thinking about how private equity deals are typically structured and your debt to equity ratio in those particular transactions. And so there's downward pressure on valuation just by definition, given where the financing markets are at. And that's where I think the focus on, you know, what's normalized EBITDA, what does the future look like, trying to get a little bit of a forward look out of a buyer is going to be your best path to yield a valuation that is going to be attractive enough for sellers to transact.
And Eric, from your perspective, when you guys are thinking about building these, you know, valuations of the companies that you're likely to acquire, what's changed in your modeling?
You know, there's a deeper dive when the contractual value, you know, to the customer. I mean, in our world, we're in a strategic mindset. So we know the business pretty well. We want to focus in on, you know, kind of key contributors. What is the labor cost in the business? What's the anticipated gross margin? What's the seasonality? Have we seen the rebound of that gross margin? Has there been inflation attached to payroll versus inflation attached to the cost price or to the price to the customer? You know, there's a lot of things that we're looking at, kind of their historical processes and how they've handled. And I do think for the most part, COVID in that time period gave us a lot of visibility into kind of the management practices and what they have and haven't done to retain customers, retain value, to retain margin, what business practices have changed and what are the impact there. So while it has been a little bit of a topsy-turvy time, it really probably allows you to center in on kind of the capability set of the management team and how they've been thinking about combating or counteracting some of the things that have happened in the marketplace. And so, you know, that certainly is a value add to us depending upon the strategy behind the target. The other piece is just looking at kind of a broad base of financials. A lot of the businesses that we look at have many years of financials. And so we get a broad spectrum from a founder-led business that looks back at, you know, 10, 15 years. And so we can get, you know, more comfortable with kind of the seasonality, the impact of the financial crisis. And so it gives us a little bit more understanding of, you know, how this is. And then we're also reaching out closer to close date and diligence to having conversations with the customer base and looking at the validating kind of the need, validating the market, validating their spend at their facility, whatever that might be. So all those things are helping us kind of get concrete around our belief. But because we've done, you know, quite a few transactions, we have a really good understanding and a proof point to point to with these founders and entrepreneurs to say, this is what the market is in terms of transaction. And here's the mechanisms or the pillar, so to speak, of that evaluation. And so we spend a lot of time in the upfront process on educating. It's a lot of what we do is getting a lot of these sellers comfortable with the process. And we're very transparent in the way that we go to market and have those conversations. And we want to make sure that they're probably going to do this one time in their career. So we don't want, I always say we're a patient buyer. We want to make sure that you're making the right decision. You're in a place to be a good partner, as are we, and the deal has to work for both of us. So we spend a lot of time on that. It's probably a very different place than maybe Adam lives today or Meredith lives today. But we're dealing with the folks that founded the business 30 years ago.
So there's differences in what I do in that in tech, many founders will go through the process many times. They're serial entrepreneurs, but I'm glad we're recording this because I'm going to share this with the ones going through it for the first time. I think what you said was so helpful for what is a buyer looking for, and you really want to get to know them and know their story and develop trust. And I think for sellers, the storytelling element is so important. Understanding your story, how you fit in with the buyer, why the buyer is excited about your company, and who's telling the story. Do you have a CFO who can play that role? Is that the role your banker is going to play? Being open with information and understanding that you're in an interview process the entire time. I've seen deals blow up because the buyer felt the seller wasn't being forthcoming. They were scared something was being hidden, and rightfully so. So I think that's just really important, is understanding those lines of communication, creating trust, and being upfront about, is this a tech play? Is this a talent play? What are we doing here? What are we building? And making sure that there are synergies, not just in businesses, but in personalities that you can build together after a deal.
So we've talked about process a few times or referenced it. I'm going to go back to Meredith, but talk me through what you see as a good process from your perspective. We'll sort of go around the horn here then to understand, because the different perspectives I think are critical here from your lawyers, your bankers, and potentially your acquirers.
Right. And I'll put on my selling hat now rather than my M&A roll-up hat. Processes can start a lot of different ways. And sometimes a company just gets a great indication of interest. But more frequently, it's a strategic conversation at the board level that, you know, in a year, it might be time to sell. Let's test the market. And you start conversations with bankers at that point. Banker conversations are free until you pick one. Talk to a lot because you're really with them until the end. And those personalities have to match. You have to trust that they know the market. Bankers can give you a lot of advice. This is me advertising for Adam, but it's not just how to sell your company. It may be that you need to build your company more before you should sell it, right? You can really develop a partnership there over time. So don't wait to talk to a banker until you have to sell. Do it a couple of years in advance. There's no harm in getting to know the bankers. I really like it when clients come to me and say, we're not quite ready to sell, but we know which bankers we want to use when we're going to do that. Lawyers should review your banker engagement letters. One note there. And then you're going to have an auction process. It's going to take time. You're going to have to kiss a lot of frogs, right? There's just a lot of meetings, a lot of companies that are going to start looking at your data. You have to be careful about what you're sharing with competitors and what you're not. You're going to take a lot of meetings. Adam can probably talk about that better than I can. And there should be strategy sessions with your board, with bankers, with your lawyers. Based on the amount of interest in the company, that's going to impact how you run an auction, what you're going to require, how fulsome your bids are going to be. And you can be realistic about that. There's a lot, there's not just one way to play it. So I find that to be a really good sign when a banker calls me and says, let's see what the interest is before we get started doing 20 different things. And you go from there. Eventually, you pick your buyer, and then the lawyer's work really starts once you have a number and you have a handshake on a number and general deal terms. And by a handshake, I mean a binding contract that's a few pages long. That means you can't talk to any other buyers. You're in what we would call exclusivity. And at that point, you're going to go toward execution of a deal. From exclusivity to having a signed deal can be as fast as a few weeks, but it's not usually in the current market. So you have to leave enough time and leave enough cash in the company to last a couple months, if not longer, because once you're out of cash, you're out of leverage. And some deals will require waiting after you sign the deal until you can close them. You might have antitrust filings that require a 30-day wait. If you have a foreign buyer, there are different filings required. So just leave time and start early is really my overarching theme, I think, as I watch Adam nodding his head.
Yeah, absolutely. I can build on that. And to Meredith's point, you know, we very often have relationships with our clients several years in advance of actual launch of a process. And it's really helpful for us just to have a little bit more perspective on a business, on the team, have tracked it for some period of time, rather than we're going to have a bake-off come in and then we're going to launch a process in a month from there. So, you know, go. And we very often have multi-year relationships with companies before we represent them in a process. I think we've seen more and more private equity firms midway through their hold kind of starting that process of saying, hey, we're going to get a couple of banks up to speed here so that they're familiar with the asset, they know the team, and you know, it's not such a quick start when they're actually ready to launch a process. So I think that part is definitely important. Certainly, we stress upfront preparation. Once we're engaged and start the process of writing a sim and moving towards a launch, we very much like to spend that upfront time pulling together diligence information, getting a virtual data room pulled together, kind of getting the ducks in a row so that once you're in a process and you know you're quote unquote exposed to the market in the sense that you're out there, you're sharing information with third parties, potentially competitors, that you have an ability to move quickly through the process and you've got a clear vision of what you're willing to share and when and how. So we do a lot of that work up front. I think to hit on a point Meredith mentioned as well, it is important to find a banker in the event you're going to go down that path that knows the industry well and knows the buyer universe well. That brings order to a process. I think it allows you to be a bit more targeted where out to the right strategic buyers, you're going out to the right private equity firms, as opposed to a generalist firm that might want to go out to 300 of their best private equity friends and run a very broad process, which can be extremely disruptive to a company to a management team that's trying to run a business. So I think finding a banker that kind of gets the company and gets the industry is extremely, extremely important. And then I think the final piece is just the speed at which a process can move and the hoops through which I, as a banker, would make the buyers jump through kind of does depend on the attractiveness of the asset, the level of interest, et cetera. With higher interest drives more speed, the ability to proceed further without exclusivity, the ability to ask for a full markup of a purchase agreement, as an example, at the submission of a letter of intent. So there's a lot of different tools that you can use in a competitive process to add to speed and certainty, but it really depends on the competitive dynamic within the process.
And Eric, what does a good process look like from your side? You can talk about it either as a purchaser of these businesses, or you've been through the other side as well.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think it's a lot of what's been mentioned in terms of when you're on the kind of on the sell side, making sure that you have the right banker. I think, Adam spoke to somebody that's in your industry specifically, that knowing both strategic buyers, but then also other private equity groups that are specialized in your market is very important. On the buyer side, it is working through that banker potentially with the management team. And I think it just comes down to that relationship building, making sure that you can kind of prove knowledge that you know the space and that the vision of the business fits well with the business that you're pursuing, being able to make sure that you're strategic about the targets that you're looking at and how that creates, I think, success synergies between the two organizations, making sure that they're better together than they are apart. And not specifically financially, just more around culture fit from a talent standpoint, more around strategic service types or capability sets, being able to, I think, articulate that and speak to that at a kind of in-depth level with a seller is very important, right? Meredith mentioned this, like seeing their vision come to fruition with your business is important, and being able to articulate what you see and how they see it is very important, right? And so I've seen it time and time again where we're not the highest bidder on an opportunity, but we are by far the best fit, and that to me wins out time and time again. And I think even more importantly, when we're in a market that requires a structure, having the faith in the team that you're partnering with is very important, right? Being comfortable with the fact that you're signing up for this purchase agreement that has an earnout or holdback or all these things that are in there. And the partner sitting on the other side of the table is in alignment with you and making sure that they're doing everything they can do to help you get that earnout or that holdback or whatever it might be. That's something that's, I think, very important that as a seller spending a lot of time on and getting comfortable with that partnership, because when you sign on the dotted line and the wires go through, and you want to make sure that who you signed up with, and it's not a Jekyll and Hyde type of scenario, is somebody who's very nice in the beginning and then that flips post-transaction. So I think pulling references, if they've done deals before, being able to speak to other owners or sellers in the space, what is it like to operate there, and how did they treat you post-transaction? I think that's very important as they think about what this might look and feel like for the future.
I think reference checking buyers is a great point. Reference check bankers, lawyers, but also buyers, private equity, strategic, who'd you last buy? Who can I talk to? And asking lawyers and bankers, have you seen this buyer get close to the altar and then walk away? Because a broken deal process can be very, very painful for a company. A couple other process points I'd note. Adam, you mentioned the virtual data room, so important. Best practices to not wait until a sale process to get that going. Like if you can keep it going on a day-to-day basis, just keep the house in order so that at any time you need to look for something, you know where it is. That's very helpful because it's painful to pull it together right before sale. You don't know where your contracts are, you can't find copies. That makes it really difficult. The other thing I would focus on is leverage points in a negotiation. I mentioned granting exclusivity to one buyer. That is when your leverage, in my mind, shifts. So any major concessions you need from buyer, you need to have before that moment. And that includes, importantly, understanding deal structure, because this is a mistake I commonly see, where a company will come to me and say, I've got this agreement that says I'm going to sell my company for $100,000. $100 million would be a better sell price. And I look at the term sheet and say, well, it's a broken tax structure. Tax laws are very nuanced, but whether you're selling assets versus whether you're selling equity can have a really big impact on the amount of money that you have to pay to the government after the deal. So you may take a different deal price based on that structure. If you're getting a mix of equity and cash, that can have adverse tax consequences. So making sure that you pin those things down, what kind of consideration you're getting and the structure, and making sure your tax legal team is looking at that, is an area people mess up. And I know it's not the sexiest thing when you hear a number you really like and you want to sell the company. Take that pause point.
Great. Well, thank you guys for diving into some depth on that. Just as a quick aside from the recruiter standpoint, CFOs who can demonstrate that they are the type of person who can build data rooms and have done so and keep those active and moving throughout the course of a hold period are very well received by private equity sponsors in the interview process and tend to do better at post-transaction in their ability to retain those positions. So that's certainly a skill that I would advocate for from the CFO side at the very least. To the point of skills, Eric, what have you learned through the last 25 transactions plus that you wish you'd known at the beginning? And what do you see as the most critical skill sets that you'd like to impart to the rest of your management team?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the soft skills. I think it's representing transparency and honesty from the beginning. I think there is an opportunity to create that relationship from the initial call, right? Being able to prove out the fact that you're the right partner for them, I think is very, very important. Meredith mentioned that it's an interview process from the first contact. It is on the buyer side as well, right? They're consistently interviewing us. And so it's an important piece for us to make sure that we treat everything above board. Everything that we say we're going to do, we do. I talk about it with my team as the say-do ratio, making sure that, you know, we're one-to-one in that, making sure that, you know, our commitments are completed and that we offer the same transparency that we're asking for the seller to provide. And so a lot of our opportunities can include rollover equity. And so our transparency in our financials is just as important as the transparency in the financials of the businesses that we're looking at. I spend a lot of time in this arena, and I spend a lot of time with people that have done amazing things and built businesses. And so being able to connect with those folks and being able to learn more about their business and also generate that relationship and ultimately hopefully partnering with them in the long run, I think is the most important thing. We have a lot of great people that work with us and for us in these transactions, but we always want to set the tone in terms of what our expectations are of ourselves and then what the expectations are of the deal team as well. So for me, that's really where it comes down to in terms of the number one skill set that I think is required in this space.
Adam or Meredith, anything else to add on skill sets you guys like to see out of your execs?
One of the things that we try to impart on our management teams is, you know, think like a buyer in the sense of being able to articulate what are the key differentiating characteristics of the business that drive value? What are the elements that create competitive moats that are sustainable that should drive interest from the buyer universe? So sort of try to frame it in a way that you're thinking of it like a buyer and understanding what they're looking for. And I think a big element of that is just as a team being able to, you know, demonstrate kind of cohesiveness and togetherness in a strategy, because, you know, very often, specifically in private equity deals, the quality and strength of the team and their ability to execute on the plan that's put forth is extremely important, maybe overweight in terms of what buyers are looking for, is having that confidence in the team and their ability to execute, being able to come off as cohesive and strong and communicative as a team, as a management team, is extremely important. And then, just as Eric said, I think the soft skills of being able to kind of comfortably demonstrate that the knowledge of your business and your subject matter as a seller, just kind of give that confidence to the buyer that you're capable and, you know, you're the type of team that they want to underwrite as part of a transaction.
So I'm going to double click on that a little bit. No surprises. Don't surprise the buyer. And if there's something you're worried about that's going to surprise them, definitely don't surprise your own team, right? You might have bankers, you definitely have lawyers. We do this all day, every day. We'll help you strategize around how to share the bad news and when to share the bad news. And I can preview for you, you're going to share the bad news, and it's going to be earlier rather than later, because it's a problem if you share it late. It's a problem if the buyer finds it on their own. But there are ways to do it that, and it, you know, what's the bad news? I always tell clients, like, just tell me where the bodies are buried. Don't let me trip over them. Definitely don't let your buyer trip over them. So whether it's text messages among the management team that people are pissed and threatening to sue each other, whether it's a really bad contract that the buyer is going to find in diligence, just tell us early. We'll figure it out. We'll find the way, and we will tell the buyer while at the same time telling them the solution to the problem. And you always, always tell the buyer. You don't cross your fingers and hope that they're not going to find it, because that's a fraud. And that's where you might finish the deal, but you're done, right? Because if they find out after a deal, you're getting personally sued. You don't keep anything, and Lindsay's never placing you again.
Good. Well, before we jump into Q&A, I'd just like an answer from each of you. Where do you see the most opportunity in the M&A market at the present?
Sure. I think it's smaller tuck-in add-on transactions, particularly within a private equity construct. I think it's now is a good time to look at particular products or technologies or particular end market segments and try to extend through smaller, more opportunistic transactions, as opposed to seeking out larger game-changing type transactions.
Yeah, I would echo that statement. I mean, that's the space I play in. So that's, I'm hopeful that that's the opportunity right now. But yeah, I mean, we're still seeing lots of opportunity in that environment, the smaller tuck-in opportunities, those new geographic territory opportunities for us, new service line opportunities in same markets with similar clients that certainly are kind of synergistic in terms of the team and the client base and the growth bases. So There's still a lot of opportunity that's in the marketplace today, but probably to Adam's point, it's not going to be the home run, really large opportunities right now, because there is still an expectation of valuation there that seems to still exist, and it'll take a little bit of time for that to come back.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The upside of this market is getting to see companies that would have been too small to be serial acquirers become serial acquirers, in that they're picking up companies that don't have a path forward. They're tucking in the talent, and they're doing it with interesting playbooks. They're paying with equity. And, you know, while it's not the ideal outcome for those companies that are being acquired, their teams are finding a home. That's the trend I see now too. But I think everyone's, you know, looking 6 months out thinking it's not going to stay this way.
Yeah, there's entirely too much dry powder out there for this to stay this way forever, and too many businesses that need to be sold. Let's go through some of these questions from a couple people. Questions about whether businesses are waiting longer to sell in part because they're fixing operational issues or focusing on their own profitability before going to market. Are you guys seeing that out there?
I can take a swing at this one, just given the space that we play in. But the things that are, I think, most kind of impactful to timing for the sellers that we're interacting with is really succession planning. It's understanding how much longer do I want to stay in the business? Do I have a second generation in the business? If so, how do I transact with them? If not, how do I look for open buyers, or is there somebody else in the business that's interested in buying the business? So it's more around kind of checking those boxes before going to an open process. But we found that it's pretty hard for certainly founders and owners that are looking to transact with employees or family. It's become pretty complicated for them to kind of realize full value there and not still stay in the business. So, you know, I think we've seen that as a good exit point for them.
Great. Lots of questions about earnouts, rollover, and debt to equity percentages. How has that shifted? Let's start with earnouts and rollovers. What percent of deals are we seeing that on? And what, generally speaking, is the volume of the requested rollover / earnout?
So we're representing a management team now that's pretty annoyed that they have to roll over. And I was able to credibly say to them, there is no deal you would do with a private equity buyer in which management would not be rolling. And if it's less than 50%, lucky you. So that's usually, I'm seeing something like that. Sometimes it's 30%, but it's often close to 50 these days. And then you do a lot of negotiating around repurchase rights. If the management team leaves, they don't necessarily get to keep that equity. They might have to sell it back at a significant discount, different prices based on why they're leaving.
Good. How about on the side of purchasing these businesses? How is the change in debt to equity ratios? And is that continuing to shift with credit markets?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely continuing to shift. If you look back a couple of years ago, I think probably a baseline would have been 40% equity, 60% debt for a traditional LBO. That may vary a little bit based on the size, but I think now it certainly flipped to at least 50-50, if not kind of, you know, moving towards potentially 60-40 equity to debt based on just where the markets are at. And so obviously that has implications in terms of the total amount that private equity firm can pay from a total enterprise value standpoint.
Cool. Let's see, just quickly here, a couple people asking about basically retrading the deal through this process. Talk a little bit about the way that is coming to light these days and how retrading is being impacted by the change in these structures, requiring more sort of management role, et cetera.
One theme to that, it feels different in every deal to me, Adam. I don't know if you feel differently about that. You know, sometimes you see a diligence finding that will result in a reduced purchase price with an earnout in case the buyer's wrong about the finding. Sometimes it's simply, hey, market conditions are different and we're going to pay less now.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's very deal specific. In theory, right, the more structure and rollover and earnout, the less chance there should be for an earnout because, you know, the buyer's de-risking it through those structural elements. But, you know, we've seen, you know, like Meredith said, either a specific diligence finding or changing market conditions, or just, you know, you work through a 2-month due diligence process and the totality of everything, you know, leads to a little bit less confidence from the board, and there's a kind of a last minute change. So it can take a lot of different forms. In theory, that structure should help, but it's just very situation specific.
Corporate carve-outs, secondary deal flow, any commentary on some of those dynamics?
Yeah, I can speak to carve-outs. I mean, we've done a bunch over the last several years from the A&D perspective. We're seeing more and more of that. I think kind of the current environment, somewhat of the choppiness, I'll say, across the marketplace is forcing, you know, boards and management teams to look at their businesses. And there's so many of these large corporates that have done acquisitions over time where a good chunk of the business is strategic, but there are chunks that are not kind of on the strategic path. And so we're seeing more and more carve out opportunities from a sell side representation standpoint. And I think that will continue just as these corporate buyers or corporate entities try to shape their portfolios and really dial them in from a truly strategic standpoint. Yeah, it creates a lot of opportunity for private equity firm because there are many that exist sort of solely to, you know, transact on corporate divestitures or, you know, others that it's a core part of their mandate. So I think that's a plus for the private equity community at large.
Great. Well, as we're wrapping up here, final thoughts from everyone, advice on M&A, current environment, views on the future, whatever you want to share.
Well, broad, Lindsay. No, thanks for having me. I think this has been great. This market won't last. So, you know, buy while you can, and then we'll shift to selling.
Yeah, thank you for having me be a part of this. I think it's, you know, it's an interesting market. You know, it takes some creativity. It takes work. And it's not just about the, you know, the total price at this point, which I find to be more probably enjoyable than just being the high bidder. You know, go back to the relationship building and some of those factors. But it's always intriguing. It's always fun. And thank you again for having me and let me be a part of this.
Yeah. And again, yeah. Thanks everybody for participating. I think from my perspective, yeah, the next 12 months are going to be more active than the last. And I would say always be thinking about your business and, you know, what the key elements are in terms of positioning yourselves if it's for a sale, and think about strategically, you know, the elements that you would look for in add-ons to be opportunistic and ready should they arise.
Well, thank you to our panelists. Sincerely appreciate your insights. I hope everyone had the opportunity to learn something here, but the takeaways for me are that it's important to ensure that you're running a process well with groups and partners that understand how everyone's going to work together going forward, and that it's right for all parties involved. With that in mind, thanks everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone.
Please tune in for our next episode with PE advisor and accomplished author Dan Kremens to discuss the idea of people-powered value creation. This is guest host Lindsay Gazowski, and thank you for listening to X Factor.